We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Saturday Night with Mike. Our special guest is John Rooney, who has been with the Cardinals since 2006. How many years now for you in the business?
Well, I'd have to add them up, Mike. I started out doing minor league ball back in 1981 with the Philadelphia Phillies down in Oklahoma City. Did that 2 years, and then 2 years in Louisville with many of the guys who were part of that 1987 reunion team that was in here earlier this season. And then moved on to the Minnesota Twins. I was with the Twins in 87, and then to the Chicago White Sox in 88. I had 18 years with them and 12 years now with the Cardinals. But overall, I think I'm at about 46 years. I started out on Jack Buck's birthday, August 21st, 1971, doing a sportscast on KLEX AM and KBEK FM in Lexington, Missouri. And I feel like Ted Knight, because it was starting out in a station in a cornfield outside of Lexington, Missouri. And now with that Ike Skelton Bridge over the Missouri River there, where they put that bridge, if they had that back in 71, I never would have been late for work because it comes out right there at the radio station. I was always getting stopped by the Lexington policeman because I was about 10 minutes late for turning the station on or signing on any number of days while working there. But what a great place to start. And in an area where you either liked the Royals or back then the A's before the Royals or the St. Louis Cardinals, or you liked them all. And I was fortunate enough, I love baseball, that I could catch the Cardinal games on KMOX, the Twins games on WCCO, out of KDKA. We could hear the Pirates, and out of Philadelphia, we could hear Bisom and the Philadelphia Phillies. And I really got hooked on baseball listening to all of those.
But you're a broadcast lifer, though. You did more than just baseball in your career. And when I look back, and you were guys you mentioned, you would come in and open up the station. You could do this, you could do that. That's something you don't see as much of anymore. But I think, and I'm sure you would agree, it was probably one of the good things, one of the great assets that you certainly can carry now.
Well, Mike, I think it's all about the people. And you get to know people by doing some sales work at the radio station. And in those small market operations in Lexington, Missouri, and Pittsburgh, Kansas, Okmulgee, Oklahoma is another place I worked. And working in Jefferson City with Missouri Network, I got to work for Stan Grieve over at KLIK and do some work for Buzzy Notch at KWOS. And you get to know the people who are buying the time on the station, supporting the radio station or supporting the network. That was really helpful for me. And learning how to deal with people on a day-to-day basis. And you're delivering the news and the hospital reports, and you're doing the swap shop at 6:15 at night where they want to sell everything they can't get rid of in the house, or play radio bingo at 10 in the morning and win some prizes down at the local hardware store. That was all fun, and it was part of the growing process, but it all made me realize I still want to do play-by-play. That's it.
I have to ask you about your meteorology skills as far as given the weather, which is one of my favorite stories from you.
Well, I was working in Pittsburgh, Kansas. I went there in 1976. And I replaced a broadcaster who had to leave in January to go to Wichita to do the Wichita Arrows AAA baseball team and do Wichita State. And that's Mike Kennedy, who's still there doing those games right now. But I had to go from Okmulgee, Oklahoma to Pittsburgh, Kansas. So I worked about a year there, and I thought, I wonder if I could get a weekend job over in Joplin on one of the TV stations and learn how to do a little television. But in order to do the TV sports, I had to do the weather before the sports on Channel 12 on KODE. So I tried to learn how to put the map together with the cold. I used to get the cold front, warm front, stationary front. I got them all fouled up. I had pilots calling me saying, you might want to turn that cold front upside down there for the way you have it for your 10 o'clock, because you really messed it up at 6. So one night, it was a Saturday night, and I wrapped up the weather by saying, you know what, rain's coming, but it looks like we're going to be fine tonight into tomorrow, so enjoy the beginning to your day, and sports is next. I go outside, it's pouring. I got in the car and I just thought, well, messed that one up, didn't I?
The Meteorology Union was not happy with that.
And I later heard, I think it was Tom Brokaw, who did weather in Omaha before he went to the national network, and one day on NBC, and I'm trying to, I think it was Brokaw, he said, for all of you in Omaha, Nebraska, I knew nothing about weather, and I apologize.
So you felt better.
So I thought, well, then that's okay.
You know, you mentioned Brokaw. You came up in an era where there were so many good, talented broadcasters in the Midwest that have had a chance to move on. Tell me about a few people you had a chance to work with in the early days.
Well, in the early days, I had a chance to go to Municipal Stadium in Kansas City. And I was 16 years old at the time, but I set up an appointment through Bob Weirs, who later became the commissioner's PR man, handled all the media relations for Uberoth. And I set it up where I could go sit in the booth with Denny Matthews, who was a young broadcaster out of Bloomington Normal, Illinois. He went to Illinois Wesleyan. And Bud Blattner. And Bud, the iconic broadcaster who did the Hawks games here in St. Louis, Game of the Week with Dizzy Dean on NBC, and did the Angels. He was the first Royals play-by-play man. And two nicer people I couldn't be around. Bud, the first advice he gave me, it's not so much how you sound, but it's what you say. Very good advice that still holds up today, because this microphone can really be a weapon if you are not responsible with it. And then Denny Matthews was always accommodating, and Denny's a great friend of this day, and I got to listen to him from Game 1 in 1969, where Lou Piniella was their leadoff batter and Rookie of the Year all the way through his Hall of Fame career. And then when I had a chance to come down to St. Louis, I mean, this was the mecca for broadcasting. KMOX Radio, with the talent that was in that stable for Bob Hyland, it was unbelievable. And when I got to become the number 10 or 11 guy on the sports staff, nobody in AM radio, I don't care how good they were in Philadelphia, LA, New York, nobody had 10 people on a sports staff. But I got to learn by watching a young Bob Costas growing up and listening to Jack Buck. Dan Kelly could not have been nicer, working with Dan Kelly, Bill Wilkerson doing Mizzou football. I was a sideline reporter, part-time spotter, and I did anything I possibly could do, and reminded me of my days at KLEX where I'd sweep up, paint the radio station, or do whatever I could do to learn. And these people were so nice and gracious to me. Bob Bregg, Bob Burns, who'd come in to do open line, they were so nice. And Mr. Bregg helped me with an opportunity to go to San Francisco to do the Giants, and I got a job offer there, but turned out they wanted me to leave the network. So I stayed with the first offer I got from Minnesota to do the Twins, but I would not have had the opportunity in San Francisco if Mr. Bregg hadn't talked to the people in charge with the Giants. And so those people were all teaching me. They gave something, so if I ever get in that position, then I need to give something back as well. But there were so many big hitters. Then when I went to CBS Claves, first weekend I worked with Brent Musburger. The next weekend I worked with Johnny Bench. Then I worked with Dick Stockton. I worked with Ernie Harwell, Bill White, Kurt Gowdy. I did my first Final Four with Kurt Gowdy. And as I'm sitting in Seattle, I'm going, Kurt, why am I here? I mean, you're the Hall of Fame. He goes, I don't want to do that play-by-play anymore. I host this and do some color. Let's just have a good time. You talk about helping a young man at a moment where I didn't know whether I could make it through the day. I was so nervous and excited about doing Houston and Virginia in the Final Four. And that was before the Phi Slamma Jamma guys grew up. They were all freshmen then. And that was Virginia without Ralph Sampson. And Virginia took them to double overtime before losing, but Kurt Gowdy couldn't have been nicer. And then working with Bill White, who later became the National League president, and a guy, one time I asked Bill for his autograph when the Cardinals played the A's over at Old Municipal Stadium in Kansas City in 1965. And I think Tito Francona had come over. He was either 65 or 66. And I said, Mr. White, do you know Tito Francona? He goes, yeah, and I hate him. And then he started laughing, that laugh of his. And then to later be in the broadcast booth with Bill White and Jack Buck working a World Series, and later Vin Scully, Johnny Bench, Vin Scully, Jeff Torborg working the World Series. I feel like Forrest Gump. I've been able to walk from coast to coast and meet everybody of any walk of life or any importance at all and get to spend time with them.
We continue with John Rooney, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you talked about nice people. I think you and I have kind of gone down a similar pattern where the people we've admired from a distance, when you have a chance to work with them, it kind of makes this job even more fun in learning that these people are everything you'd hope they would be.
You know, I mentioned a lot of the big hitters that I've been fortunate to be around, but let's talk about some people who are just as important, if not more so. Guys like Jim Holder. Yes. When I went to KMOX, Jim had been over at KSD Radio, and I was on a tryout for 1 month over at KSD Radio, and I was hired because Mr. Highland was hiring away all the talent over there trying to crush the competition, which he was so good at doing. But Jim Holder took me in and showed me the ropes over there and introduced me to everybody. Tim Dorsey later worked with Tim. He brought me back to St. Louis over at KTRS when I came here to do the Cardinals, but I worked doing the FM sports. Well, that was the last thing I did after the midnight sports, record the FM sports for the next day when Tim was running FM, and got to know him. And John Angelides was so nice to me at KMOX Radio, and a guy named Art Fleming, who was the original Jeopardy host. Art Fleming, the original Jeopardy host. When Art came in one night from being at the Fox Theater or something, or maybe he was at the Muni because there was a strike looming. And I was on strike duty. I was there all night if I had to see if baseball was going to strike or whatever. He walked in about 7 o'clock. Hey, if there's anything I can do for you, type up some copy or whatever, let me know. But Art Fleming, it couldn't have been nicer. And I thought, wow, this guy's been around forever and he's going to help some kid. That's what that station was full of at the time. They had some big hitters, but they had people that were willing to cross over the boundaries of what they were doing, whether it was talk or news or sports. If you could do a little bit of everything, that made you a better broadcaster. And that's one thing I learned a couple of stints at KMOX before finally getting to come back here in 2006.
You know, that's a good point you make, being that utility person. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about, we talk about nice people. Who was the person that, A, gave you the legitimate shot, and also the person who believed in you when maybe you weren't sure?
Well, when I was 16, I walked into KLEX, and I had just passed my third phone operator's license. I actually got a permit because I passed elements 1 and 2, but failed 9, the very technical element that you had to have to be able to turn on a low-level transmitter and sign on a station. But Ray Beckwith was the manager. They called him Smokey. He always had a cigar in his mouth and a great personality. And I said, Ray, I'm going to do sports for you. And after he picked himself up off the floor laughing, he said, there's a room over there. Get some AP wire copy and do a 5-minute sports cast. If it's any good, I'll put it on the air today. And that was on August 21st, 1971. After doing a 5-minute sports cast, that took about 4 hours and 15 minutes to put together. He aired it, and then I got started working before school and after school, my junior and senior year, and filling in, doing weekends, and it became kind of a part-time, full-time job. But I loved it. I got to learn how to use some really bad technical equipment they had there, because they didn't have the best of the best when it came to turntables. Yes, they played records back then.
How about the tape machines where you had to edit on your own with some scotch tape and a good razor blade?
But I liked that. I could do that. I learned to do that, and it came in handy when I went to CBS Radio because we had the old Ampex machines that actually had the cutting block right there. That was big time compared to what I learned in the smaller markets. When I went down to Pittsburgh, Kansas, though, Jim Harbard was one of the owners of the station down there, AM and FM. He used to work for the Gates Company that sold all the broadcast equipment. He had the state-of-the-art stuff in there. It was like, boy, I was driving the luxury model and having a great time there. But I learned on the other stuff. And at CBS, I remember putting a show together for Sports Central USA, weekend update show, that Win Elliott made famous. It used to be 15 minutes, then down to 10 minutes, then down to 7, down to 5. It was down to 3 minutes by the time I got there. So you had to be really quick with your edits. Well, I'm editing a show, and some people from Sony over in Japan, they were coming through the broadcast center, and they said, well, here's where we're going to do our sports, and we do a lot of our news programming. And one of the folks from Japan said, you have a very nice museum. Now, where are your studios? And those were the studios. They had all the state-of-the-art equipment over in Japan, and I've become a connoisseur of the gadgets when it comes to high-end music players and going from the Walkman, I've been there through the entire history of the Walkman up to the high-res players, and to know where they were coming from, I thought, I'd like to see those studios.
I'm amazed you didn't learn the language of Japanese, considering how much you are an admirer of what they produce when it comes to the electronic equipment we even use here.
When I did the Olympic coverage in Norway in 94, I had a chance to see where we were going with high-def television, mm-hmm. because they had the monitors on display in the broadcast center over there, and through translator talked to some of their technicians, and I thought, boy, we have a long way to go here, but it didn't take too long.
Yeah,
it kicked in, and now the resolution just keeps getting better and better and better, but that's where they took the first big steps toward high-def back in the Olympics in 94.
Is it amazing, and you've been at this for a while, how much the equipment has changed and how much it's made our business, I wouldn't say easier, but certainly it gives us better quality in what we do.
Well, we've gone from reel to reel to a cassette tape to a mini disc, digital audio tape before the mini disc, and that didn't work out so well because that was, you had to use an editing station to edit that and have a pre-roll. Well, that's not going to go over when you're editing on the fly in radio. And now we use the flash drives on recorders. They're so small, they sound so good. And with what we have with broadcast equipment, how the use of satellite and how the use of the internet is bringing these games to the broadcast facilities and then over the air to fans, and all of the streaming that's going on right now, where you can either hear or see something just by signing on or going to a website. It has come a long, long way. And some have said one of these days we're going to have games where they're played in a studio and then you just watch them. I don't see that day coming. And here's why. Recently at the Cardinals Hall of Fame induction ceremony, Mark McGwire was so choked up to be able to stand there. And he's a bench coach now, and he was a successful hitting coach here in St. Louis and a super successful hitter. But it was the roar of the crowd, I guarantee you, that brought tears to his eyes. Vin Scully stayed in this business so long because I guarantee you he was so hooked on the roar of the crowd that brought the excitement to the game and meaning to what we do here on a day-to-day basis. I don't ever see that happening because in St. Louis, I've seen these fans will this team to win just by being down on the field, to go on the field for the Star of the Game show like you do. I've felt it so many times, and that's something you cannot replace by playing a game in some studio.
We continue with John Rooney, and I want to get into the play-by-play thing because that's something people come up to you all the time, especially young people, and I'm of the belief that a lot of them don't understand how to pay dues. They just want to do it right now, and you've been a great help to me about play-by-play. A, when did you know this is what you wanted to do, and B, you remember that first job and how you sounded and how things went from there?
I wanted to do this, Mike, when I was 8 years old. I listened to Monty Moore and George Bryson doing the Kansas City A's. I listened to Harry and Jack doing the Cardinals. And then I started listening to other broadcasters I mentioned earlier and thought, wow, and the roar of the crowd got me.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, you could be at the ball game and talk about it, and you get to meet all the players, and you get to go where they play. That's what I want to do. And my cousin, Dennis Rooney, who passed on in the last year or so, was a pretty good newsman on the air in Kansas City for a number of years. He wanted to be a rock jock on WHB, the sister station of KXOK here in St. Louis, and play that 40-star survey on Fridays and count them down. I said, you can do that? He said, sure, that's what I'm going to do. Well, he took a different path and became a very good newsman. But I thought, well, I want to be a baseball broadcaster. So that's what I'm going to do. And my close friend, Tony Grosso, who coached at Jeff City for a while after Pete Atkins, I think he was the second coach after Pete retired there. Tony and I grew up playing baseball together. He went to Lexington High School. I went to Richmond, about 10 miles away. But we always played summer baseball. And Tony, in our eighth grade yearbook, said, you're going to be the voice of the A's one of these days. And so that's when I had kind of an idea that that's what I want to do and how I'd like to do it. So,
for you, when you finally said, okay, I want to do this, I'm going to do this, You remember the first game and how that went?
Oh, I remember the first game vividly. I was a junior in high school and had just played, I just broadcast football. I was kind of the analyst, and I didn't know much about it. And there was an older analyst who was doing Lexington High School football. I was doing Richmond, and Richmond won the state championship that year, beating Fulton and Tony Galbraith. So that was kind of a fun run while you're in high school. But I admittedly didn't know the X's and O's of a former coach who, that Rooney kid doesn't know anything. Well, coach, you're right. I didn't. But I was learning the X's and O's. I wanted to be a play-by-play man, not an analyst. And I remember doing that. But finally, when I got a chance to do some play-by-play, it was a Slater game against Richmond in the Missouri River Valley Conference Tournament at Wentworth Military Academy. I went through the game, and I followed some advice that I got from Bud Blatner. It's what you say, and it's describing a game. You look at it, you describe it. And I was a little better versed in basketball, and I played a lot more basketball than I had football as a kid. And when I got back to the station that night, there was a guy named Gary Franklin who went on to work for MCA, the record business, and as a programmer. And Gary said, you know what, kid, you do a really good job, but here's one thing you have to correct. You're ending too many sentences up. Just put a period at the end of the sentence and bring it down. You'll have a better flow. So the next night I had another game. It was a tournament. I tried that out, came back to the station. He goes, now you're on to something. Now just get comfortable with it. But I thought, I felt pretty comfortable with that. And always enjoyed basketball. But one of the best games I ever did was Missouri and Kansas State in the Big 8 postseason tournament. It was in the 1977-78 season. Stan Ray had a broken hand, and Larry Drew was part of that, and Missouri had a losing record, but beat Kansas State to go to the NCAA tournament. Well, my dad kept stats for me. I don't think I ever sounded better before or after that than that game, and my father died the next day. But he got to keep stats for that game, and I used that game to get a lot of jobs.
You know, it's funny you talk about using a game or a game tape. One of the things that you run across when you're doing games, I think the high school games are harder to do than the college and the pro games because, A, you don't know the talent as well, you don't recognize them as well. They're not as efficient as they are at the higher levels. How much of a challenge was that for you, and did it make you a better broadcaster?
I got to work with my buddy Rod Kelly for the first time in over 40 years this past year doing a high school game in Columbia at Norm Stewart's Coaches Against Cancer. 48 hours of high school basketball, boys and girls games. They played all the way around the clock from Friday night until late Sunday. And we did Columbia Battle and Poplar Bluff. It was really hard to do. And I tried to do my homework, talk with the coaches about the players, and I was really delighted by the talent level that we saw. And it was a tough, tough played game that went about 2 hours. High school games don't go 2 hours. College games go two hours plus. But that one did because it was so well played and so closely contested. And the officials messed it up a little bit, called a basket interference when no one touched the ball coming through the net. So they awarded free throws, and the official scorer gave each team a point on the young player's two free throws. So things got a little out of whack there, but hey, it's not an easy job. Yeah. For the people who volunteer their time to go do that. So I gained a respect for those guys doing high school basketball, football, baseball. I used to do it all the time in Lexington, Pittsburgh, Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and got to meet some really wonderful people. I was doing Babe Ruth baseball in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and they made it all the way to the national tournament in Colorado Springs. Well, they played a team from New Hampshire, and a young left-handed batter pitched and hit, and the pitcher won, and as a hitter hit a couple of home runs. I didn't think a thing about it. Years later, I was sitting in the back of the plane with Steve Sachs and Mike LaValliere and some of the White Sox and talking about youth baseball. I said, well, yeah, I went to the Babe Ruth National Tournament back in 1977 or 76, and he goes, I played out there. Well, we played a team from New Hampshire. Yeah, I pitched in that game and hit a home run. It was LaValliere. And I found the box score later, and sure enough, it was Spanky.
How about
who pitched, and Bob Lobel was their play-by-play man, who went on to become a sportscaster at NBC in Boston and was there over 30 years. So it is a small world, and you never know who you're going to run into. But Spanky, well, yeah, I hit a home run against those guys, and I was the winning pitcher.
It's amazing. We talked about this recently. The 87 team that was here, you knew those guys, a lot of those guys in the minors. It's fun to be part of some of those guys, that their careers early on, and then they ascend. You do their games. Ricky Horton is a guy you work with. I mean, how much fun is that to watch people ascend and then you work with them or you know them personally?
I think by spending the 4 years in the minors, and I've known so many people who've been there 20 and 30 years, but I gave myself 4 years, and if I couldn't do something with that, then I thought, I'll go try something else. I'll do the basketball and the football. And I came back to KMOX before the season ended in 84 just because I didn't see anything on the horizon as far as a major league job. Lo and behold, I did a Final Four the next year, and then was offered the CBS Radio Game of the Week, and then it really took off. But I was very fortunate to meet all those young players and got to know the likes of Razor Shine and Howard Johnson and Mike Lauga. Got to meet Jim Leland while he was managing in Evansville before he became such a great major league manager. And got to meet Ernie Harwell when they came down during the strike in 1981. The Tigers, they did their AAA games back to WJR in Detroit. And you run across those people. But I always thought I had a little bit of a leg up when I got the CBS radio game because I knew so many of the guys from the American Association that I had someone to go to on that team and find out, well, what's going on with your club, and could throw a nugget in here or there during the course of the play-by-play. So I think that really helped out. But it was a close team down in Louisville where we had Dave Cable playing first base, and we had Jeff Doyle playing second, Jose Uribe, who became Jose Gonzalez, yeah. And then we had a number of people playing third, and then Pendleton settled into that and nailed that job down. We had Tommy Nieto and Mark Salas catching. Andy Van Slyke was there for a little bit when I was down there. We had a guy named Gary Racich. His brother Dave was a lefty who pitched for Texas. Gary was a big home run hitter in the Mets organization and hit a bunch down there for Louisville, but never really did much at the big league level. But that particular group, and Willie McGee, of course, passed through there, and that particular group, led by Vince Coleman in the leadoff role and his stolen bases, they set the table for some really good Cardinal runs in the 80s, and then I got to spend time with them as I started doing Game of the Week. So how blessed could you be to have those relationships and those friendships?
As we continue with John Rooney, you get to the big leagues. How much fun was that for you initially? Because you'd really worked, you paid your dues, and you get to the big leagues. What was that experience like? Because you've walked into some pretty good situations.
The first big league game I did was exciting, scary, and didn't work out so well. I was called up. Dan Kelly had to go do some Hockey Night in Canada work, so I was called up after the Louisville team won its division the night before and drew the millionth fan, the first minor league team to draw 1 million fans in a season. And so I was called up to Cincinnati to work with Jack and Mike on a Cardinal game. Well, I'm so amped up, I'm calling play-by-play like it's a fast break in the Final Four. George Hendrick's double must have sounded like a game-ending breakaway slam dunk. And Jack Buck looked at me and, kid, you better slow down because you're going to wear them out. You have 162 of these. And we had a play early in the game where one of the Reds, and it may have been, I can't remember right off the top, but one of their first two or three hitters drops a bunt, and the throw at first hit him in the back in fair territory. Jack said, I think the ball hit him as he came out of the batter's box. And I'm thinking, no, Jack, it hit him on the throw. He was in fair territory. And then it dawned on me, you just corrected Jack Buck. That's not a very smart thing to do here in the first inning of a game you're trying to work in your first big league effort. And so the general manager of the Reds is next door. What happened on that play? Ah, Jack, he was running in fair territory and got hit in the back. I go, thank you, thank you, thank you. But Jack gave me some pretty good pointers there, and later got to work with Jack and Johnny Bench in the World Series on CBS Radio. And we used to sit at breakfast at the hotel before going out to the ballpark for a World Series game, sit that day for probably 3-4 hours, just telling stories, laughing. And those are times that I'll never forget, and you can't trade those for anything. But that first game I did, though, And I think I called a play a frozen rope. And I even heard recently on MLB someone describe the term frozen rope. Jack said, it's not a frozen rope. It's a hit. A frozen rope has ice on it. What is the temperature? You know,
you know, I had a moment like that with Jack. I was spotting for him for Monday Night Football out in Arizona. And Ed Too Tall Jones had made the tackle, and Jack said it was somebody else. And I kept pointing at the spotter sheet, and he would look at me, and he gave me this look like, who in the heck are you trying to correct me? And I kept pointing, so he now he takes his headphones off. Are you going to argue? And I just said, well, look at the replay. And the replay had Ed Too Tall Jones, and he kind of looked at me like, okay, Mr. Know-It-All. But he was a very gracious person about sharing knowledge with you and helping you be better, but he would have some fun with you along the way.
Well, he wanted you to get it right.
Yeah,
that's what it came down to, get it right. John Miller has a thing where he says, if you make a mistake and you correct it, it's not a mistake. That's it, then you move on. We're on the air so long, yeah, and we're going to make mistakes and flub up a name here or there, or get names confused, because after 40 some years in the business, some of them start to run together. But it's being around these good young players, whether it's baseball, basketball, or football. And I love doing the Valley because I get to spend time with the coaches. I enjoy the shoot-arounds more than I enjoy the games, just being with the coaches, their assistants, and getting to meet some of the good young stars that play in that league. That's made it fun for me, and that's why I got back into doing college basketball with the Valley 5 years ago.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about stories. We're pretty blessed to have Mike Shannon with us every day and Ricky Horton. And I think one of the fun things about what we do, the games are great, don't get me wrong. I think the storytelling that we've been able to share in this booth, and we run into people on the road or other people who come by the booth, isn't this what this game is all about, the storytelling and the things they've seen and done?
Well, there's so many things you can get out of ball one, ball two, or foul ball to the upper deck, unless you're Ernie Harwell. There's a foul ball behind the plate. It goes to the upper deck, and it's caught by a man from Hamtramck. And people are going, how did he know? He used to pick out a different town, a different name, but that's the way Ernie made a foul ball sound good. The stories make it, and Ernie Harwell was one great storyteller. Even Babe Ruth signed his shoe, and that was one of his books, The Babe Signed My Shoe. He didn't have anything else to sign. There's Babe Ruth. Here, sign my shoe, please. But it is stories like that are interesting. And everybody, one of my favorite people at CBS was Charles Kuralt. Yeah. And he believed everyone had a story, no matter who you were, how famous or how remote part of the country you may live, you have a story. And with some of these stories they come up with baseball and my friends have some great stories just from their days following baseball that I've been able to relate some of those. And for the first 8-9 years I worked with Mike, I recall hearing the same story maybe more than once. And something's going to happen on the field that will trigger something else that he'll get into something from that past, whether it's playing at Heinie Miney or whether it's playing against Whitey Ford and the New York Yankees in the 64 World Series, or watching Mark McGwire in his home run chase with Sammy Sosa, or watching the Cardinals win World Series in 2006 and 2011 and everything in between. There's a whole treasure trove full of stories in all of that.
You're the only man to win back-to-back World Series as a broadcaster in the American League and the National League. Our first year together, we're in San Diego, and I just matter-of-factly said, what's the biggest moment for you in your career as a broadcaster? And you kind of say, I don't know, I did this and did that. And Ronnie Belliard made that play in San Diego that I thought saved the series and probably put the Cardinals in the World Series, and they eventually won it. And I'll never forget, you looked at me, you said, that was it right there. You've had some great runs and some great calls about a lot of different things. Which ones, as you look back, really stand out to you now as you've come to appreciate?
John Sunbold hitting a jump shot at Ahern Fieldhouse in Manhattan, Kansas, to give Missouri its third consecutive Big Eight title. And that was on my birthday back then. That was special. Albert Pujols hitting a home run against Detroit. in the 06 World Series. That's probably the one I enjoy the most because I know how much the Cardinals meant to my dad and how much time we spent in the car trying to pull KMOX in or KFEQ out of St. Joe to get the Cardinal games because the Philco in the house wouldn't quite bring it in until KMOX was at full power at nighttime. So I know how much that would have meant to him to know that I was broadcasting Cardinal baseball. But being able to do that first Final Four with Kurt Gowdy was very special. And as it works out, Claves, there's so much fate involved. Had Dickie Beal been called for traveling for Kentucky against Illinois, I wouldn't be sitting here right now.
Really?
I did that game for CBS Radio with Ed Ingalls, and if Kentucky was out, then Kaywood Ledford would have been doing the Final Four, not me. So they go on to the Final Four. I go to the Final Four. Dick Brescia at CBS Radio hears me, hires me to do Sports Central USA Game of the Week, football show with Jack Buck and Hank Stram because NBC Radio took the football Monday night away for 2 years. And I got to do so many things at CBS Radio, all because Dickie Beal was not called for traveling.
Did you ever send him a note or the referee?
No, but I've talked about it enough. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. The next day, I came here to St. Louis and did the Houston-Wake Forest game that put Houston into the Final Four, and then I did Houston-Virginia the next weekend. You talk about living the dream. I was on cloud nine that whole time.
Muggsy Bogues was on that Wake Forest team. Yeah.
Mr. Bugsy, as one of my colleagues called him, or Muggsy. Or
Final segment with John Rooney. We're having a good time shooting the breeze here. You've been doing this baseball for obviously a long time, and you watch this game change from a strategy standpoint. You see the players come and go, the dimensions of the ballpark. What do you like most about what you see, and what are you concerned about?
I think the game that we grew up watching, Claves, is so different now, and I don't think that's a bad thing in all concerns, but I still think little things win baseball games, advancing runners and putting pressure at all cost on the opposition. It is great to talk about home run distance with launch angle and the speed of the home run off the bat and all that, but to me, that doesn't win championships. What wins championships? Good pitching, good defense, timely hitting. And I think that'll be the same until the earth comes to an end because that's the way these World Series are won. Timely hitting last year after a rain delay. The Cubs had a chance to bat. They scored the go-ahead runs and beat the Cleveland Indians. Timely hitting, good pitching. It got it done for them, even though it took them 108 years to do so. They finally got it done. And that's what's going to win games. But the excitement of the launch angle, watching home runs fly into Big Mac land or fly in between the scoreboard in right center field like we saw in home run derby for Prince Fielder. My goodness, those are fun to watch. But to watch a good diving play or a well-executed double play, we saw a triple play in Boston this year, 5-4-3 around the horn. Those are exciting things to me, and I love to see a triple. I like to see an inside-the-park home run every now and then. It's just you come to the ballpark, you're going to see something you haven't seen before in most cases. And if you follow the game, you study the game, and if you really get into it, and I hope kids of this generation will have that desire to do so because it makes it a lot more fun to follow the game the more you know about it.
What's your concern? There's a lot of things they're trying to change and or tweak. What do you like to see more of and what would you like to see less of?
Well, do we have too many sporting events out there where people can pick and choose where it doesn't become that important to follow a certain game or event? And that's where we're very lucky, Claves, with the Cardinals, because these fans love the Cardinals and they want to know everything day in and day out. But in other markets, I don't think they're as fortunate. So that concerns me a little bit, but the more you have out there, again, it's what I was saying, the more you know about it, and that may be a good thing. But I hope that the big TV contracts, they can pay them. There's enough advertising out there to keep that going, because these teams are going to put that right back into their resources, developing players and signing free agents or making deals and signing contracts that will keep these teams competitive. That's a good thing, too. I don't see too many downsides. I think they're trying to do some things to cater to younger fans, and that's always a good thing. But let's get kids playing more baseball in the inner cities, as well as the travel league teams are all good for the really good players. Those kids benefit from that. But I like to see kids who just love to pick up a bat and swing and make contact and go chase the ball around the park a little bit and enjoy it and go out and have fun. I'd like to see more opportunities for them. And Redbird Rookies is providing that in a way in St. Louis. I'd like to see that all over the place.
You grew up in an era like me where uniforms were just something really special. You went out and played. You didn't need a uniform. I mean, you really didn't need umpires. You had a few coaches, parents that would come out and show you how to do this and do that. I think they've got to go back to the basics and try and get kids to just say, just come out and try it, and we'll kind of feed you a little bit more and more each time out.
Then the key words are have fun.
Yeah.
Just go out and have some fun. Go play. And the first time I hit a ball over a fence a little leaguer, oh, that felt good. I like that. I just hit a home run. And I didn't hit many, but that was fun. And then I watched Rocky Colavito do that. I saw Lou Brock do that, leading off a game, and that's what it feels like, just to be a part of that and make a running catch, or if you're a pitcher, strike out a batter, or make a good play covering first base, and that's all positive. Those positive things, you know what? And then win the game and shake hands at the end. That's pretty fun and pretty special as well. And I hope the kids go out and have fun and do that, and they have those opportunities. But sometimes it gets a little too competitive and a little too heated, and you know, winning at that point is not everything. Competing, to me, is, and learning how to compete and learning how to take the bad with the good.
You said fun. I'd be remiss if we didn't bring up one Mike Shannon when it comes to fun. We've been up in this booth for a few years now, and I try and tell people, you have no idea how much fun we have. It starts with the big guy, and he'll say something or do something, and you and I just kind of look at each other. And that's what makes this job what it is. I mean, we show up, and I've said it before, there's never a day I haven't come to work where I haven't laughed at something.
Well, trust me, not every radio booth or broadcast booth is like this one. It's pretty competitive in this business, right down to where a guy sitting next to you might not have the same idea you have about doing a good job with the broadcast. And I've been involved with that for a couple of times, but I'd have to say I'm very fortunate for most of my career where the goal was, let's have fun and do a good broadcast. And if you do that, then the fans will have fun. And that's the way it is up here. We laugh about something every day. There's no question. The number one question I get when I'm making appearances, how do you work with Mike Shannon? What's it like? And this is exactly what it's like, whether it's a name he may say or a story or just something that he may pull right out of the sky, and we'll look at each other like, I'm not sure I would have thought of that, but it's pretty funny, and we do have a good time, no question there.
You have fun because you're a student of this industry. Broadcasters, whether it's Vin Scully or Harry Carey or Ernie Harwell, and you kind of made a name for yourself being able to impersonate those guys too, and people get a kick out of it. Once you get rolling, man, people are like, holy cow, not only is he funny, he's really good at these guys.
Well, the problem is most of the guys that I've impersonated are no longer with us, and so a lot of the young fans won't have an idea. Now, Vin Scully certainly is, but I used to do the scoreboard on White Sox games impersonating broadcasters from one of the two teams I'm doing the scores. In Kansas City, the Royals lead 3-2. I'm Denny Matthews. And Milo Hamilton here. You know, you're going with me to the Hall of Fame, Claves, but you got to pay your way in. Milo's not with us anymore. And the Cubs lose. You know, Harry would never say that, but that's I kind of enjoyed it from the White Sox standpoint. But I'd use the different voices. And Ernie Harwell doing the Tigers scores. And Tigers lead 3-2 in the fourth. But I since got away from that because not too many people would remember anymore, those guys.
You know, I'll tell you another great moment I saw for you. When Vin Scully was here, I think maybe the last time he was here, or next to last time, because he didn't travel. He was here for a playoff game, and he signed your media guide. It was his media guide, a Dodger media guide, and he signed it. And the look on your face is that same look a kid gets when he gets his first autograph from a big leaguer.
And another thing he asked me to do was take a photo of Vin and Red together. Red Shandings was up here in the booth. Yeah. And I still have that photo, and I've since sent it on to Vinny, and he had it blown up and has it displayed in his house, I guess. But he wanted that picture, and you had two redheads sitting right next to each other with with Red and Vin, and a lot of respect there. And Vinny had so much respect for Stan Musial, and vice versa. Stan, I know, liked Vinny. And working with Vinny, he has a different style. He is always talking, and it's always interesting what he has to say. I think he's a one of a kind. I don't think he can be impersonated by someone else trying to do that style in this game. What I learned from Jack Buck, though, was pacing, where it's okay to have some crowd noise come up and let that blend in, and I think that crowd noise is good. Now, where Vinny uses the crowd noise, he'll call a play and then stop. The crowd will swell. It may be 10, 15 seconds, and then Vinny will finish off the call, and he'll always say the right thing. Jack did too. They had a knack of always saying the right thing at the right time.
I'm out of time, as a matter of fact. I thank you for yours, and I thank you for what we've been able to establish here on this broadcast. I've learned so much from you, and continue to listen and learn. And that's one of the things that I think young people might want to pay attention to. If you listen more than you talk, when you do talk, people will listen.
What'd you say?
I forgot already.
I tend to agree with you, Claves, and that's the best part of interviewing, is listening to what that person says in your interview and then playing off of that. That's one thing I learned from Jack. Jack was the best at it. He could take what you said, turn that into maybe an hour conversation just by playing off your answers. But listening is a big, big part of it. And sometimes in the communication business, we're the worst communicators. That can always get better. But around here, the communication's pretty good, and we have a lot of fun, and I count my blessings every day.
Thank you, buddy.
You got it, Mike.
He's John Rooney. I'm Mike Claiborne. We thank you for listening.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.